If you've enjoyed this podcast, then you're going to love Doctors Aren't Annoying Me live on stage in London's West End this Christmas. Oi! That's right. Operation Ouch Live is back, a brand new stage version of our double BAFTA-winning show on Children's BBC, running from the 4th of December to the 16th of January. Tickets available at operationouchlive.com. It's not for the squeamish, and that's why we've called it Not for the Squeamish. Oh, yeah.
People do get us muddled up, but I think that's because they're being very, very lazy. Like, they don't care. And I do this all the time, right? And there's all sorts of situations where you think, oh, is it James or John? You know, I don't know. And I think people do that to us. And then it feels like, because you're a twin, but it's not. We look significantly different.
Okay, if you were presenting me as a patient to, you know, at medical school, you have to present the patient.
The next patient is a 42-year-old man.
42-year-old Caucasian man in poor condition.
Poor body habitus.
Zahn's my identical twin, and he's really my big brother. He's 7 minutes older, but he's a lot heavier. I feel like you're just like me, but you just have smeared another layer on.
Like if you were wearing four coats.
That's a really good example, yes. I always think that you think that I think that you look bad, or that I wish you looked another way.
Mm.
But actually, you never looked great as a slim person.
Neither one of us looks that great when we're thin.
No, we're scrawny.
We look haggard with weak shoulders.
We're both easing comfortably into our dad bods.
I'm never write a body like either of us have into a book.
Or a movie.
Well, like at least a book that was going to sell well in an airport, you know. Like those kind of books are always like the big man's muscles rippled as he, you know, attached the silencer to his sniper rifle or something. You know, like that kind of a scene. You'd never then write in that he had a bit of a
weak chin. The angle of his jaw was like an architectural projection.
His shoulders sloped dramatically away from his neck.
A face of varnished teak.
No one would ever read that description and be like, oh, I want to be like, you know, that guy.
In fact, Zahn and I have a bigger difference between our weights than any other pair of identical twins studied in the UK.
What I notice is that 20 kilos more than you, nobody cares. Genuinely no one cares.
You're not the big twin or the fat twin.
No.
No one else might care about Zahn's weight, but I really do. Because he's overweight, he has a COVID-induced problem with his heart.
I don't think any interviewer has ever asked either of us about our weight, ever. Even when I've been promoting my diet book, it hasn't come up that much.
And this is the weird thing about Zahnd. He's a sort of weight loss expert. He's a medical doctor. He's got a degree in public health. He's made hundreds of hours of television about weight and nutrition. And yet, he's clinically obese. Last year, he went into hospital four times to have his heart shocked into a normal rhythm.
Hi, Mama. His heart's in a funny rhythm.
I woke up at 3 a.m, quite panicked. And then I started to just feel really, really, really ill.
Everybody off, please. Hands off. Everybody step away. Charging. Okay, shocking. Everybody wait.
Oh!
Heart's back in normal rhythm. Deep breath in and out. All done, sir.
So I think that you'd imagine the moment of crisis was going, oh, it's when your heart had stopped. But I think actually it's the last sort of couple of months where really privately I have been exhausted permanently. I feel immensely creaky and old and unfit.
Listening to Zahn acknowledge this but still not doing anything about it is really painful for me and for the rest of our family.
And I think I used to feel like fat and healthy. My life has become chaotic. The additional chaos of lockdowns and shopping queues and everything else means that I eat more takeaway, I'm in more, I'm socialising less, I'm eating for fun more. Like, what am I going to do? I feel like what I'm going to do as long as my life's chaos is just keep doing what I'm doing and feeling terrible, to be honest.
Never mind his heart. Simply because of his weight, Zahn is likely to die a long time before me, which is something so awful it's hard to really properly imagine it. It's not just that I want to help him. I feel like I have to help him. And that's what this podcast is all about. This is a thorough examination with Dr. Chris, that's me, and Dr. Zand. Series 1, Addicted to Food. If you're listening to this in the UK, you, like me, are probably overweight. 60% of us are. And there's now lots of evidence that the main reason for most of our excess weight, including Zand's, is something called ultra-processed food, also known as UPF. It's been around since the 1960s, and it's gradually become the main thing that we eat. There's a long formal definition, but it's basically anything wrapped in plastic with an ingredient you don't find in a domestic kitchen. Some UPF is really obvious, chicken nuggets, frozen pizza, but some isn't. Baby food, health snacks, lots of healthy cereals. I think UPF is driving Zand's weight problem.
If you go, no, but engage with the problem of you being overweight and unhealthy, it's upsetting. You know, it's not, it's like I'm just being honest and going, what am I meant to do?
It's a good question. Are we really in control of what we eat? Or was it written into our genes generations ago when food was scarce?
My wife calls me a good doer. She thinks I'm incredibly efficient and I love my food. So those are two toxic mixtures in which I love my food, I will cook and I will eat. And so the only way that I eat and love what I do is by exercising, which sounds terribly masochistic, but it is a big reason why I exercise.
You mean that you exercise not to get fit or because it's good for you, but in order to justify the evening excesses?
Clearly, I know the benefit of exercise. You know, as
sure,
someone...
Sure, sure. Yeah.
Blah, blah, blah. But it gives me... I shouldn't be admitting this, but I do. I mean, it just makes me smug when I eat after I've exercised.
I wanted Zand to speak first to Giles Yeo. He's a friend, but he's also a world-class geneticist. He studies the effects of genes on weight at Cambridge University. Like Zand and me, he loves food. He's written a brilliant book, Gene Eating, The Story of the Human Appetite. Giles' research suggests that our genes have a really powerful influence over how much we weigh. But if our genes do play a role, Zand and I are identical twins. We have the same genes. Why is Zand so much bigger than me?
The background for this, Giles, is that this year I got ill with COVID. As a result of COVID, or at least coincidentally with it, I got atrial fibrillation, which has not gone away. And that is definitely something that's made worse by being overweight and by being unfit, both of which I am. 40, 50 years ago, overweight and obesity were rare. And now they're not just common, it's a majority of the population in the UK are overweight or obese. Our genetics haven't changed, and you're the geneticist, so where is all this coming from if it's not our genetics?
So you're right, our genes haven't changed. So I'll give you the analogy. So imagine if the both of you stand there and look exactly alike, and imagine that it's the 1950s. So fast forward a few years on, and now we're going to environmentally challenge you. And the environmental challenge for you is me coming along and shoving you and shoving Chris. Okay, I'm going to shove both of you. But unbeknownst to me, you, Zand, have a sprained calf muscle. And so I shove Chris, and he tenses up and stays still, whereas I shove you, and because of your dodgy leg, you crumple and fall to the ground. You're both still the same, but because a change in environment has then exposed the susceptibility to have to being shoved. And so the analogy being that in the 1950s, you looked alike with no one pushing you, whereas now something is pushing us. And the push, the shove, is the environment. It's the food environment that we actually live in. And some people are more susceptible to not being able to say no, to be more driven towards food in this food environment. And that's what it is. So while our genes haven't changed, the environment has made some people with more susceptible genes suddenly appear.
The picture you're describing is that everyone's got different genetics, and whereas in the 1950s the challenges to weight gain are smaller, now at the moment there is a whole different food environment that is presenting itself differently to us. But Chris and I have become quite different despite having exactly the same genetics. Where would you then look for the explanation for that?
Yeah, how do you explain that, Giles?
Yeah, come on, Giles, you're the geneticist. We've got him.
We've got him now.
He's just going to hang up.
I'm going to hang up. I'm going to
hang up and quit. Quit his job.
We'll come back to Giles in a moment. Don't worry, we're all still friends. But how did Zand and I get so different? We started our lives as an inseparable pair.
Christopher was in the bath and Sandy had been to a party and came home with a party bag, but brought one for Christopher too. And you climbed into the bath and you were chatting away, telling him about the party. It was like two little old women chatting. I remember saying to you, it must be nice to be a twin. And you both looked up and said, yes, it is. And then you just kept chatting.
I really remember bath time from being a kid. We had this amazing pirate ship. We were speaking to our mum, who at the time was pretty much the only person in the world who could tell us apart.
If you've enjoyed this podcast, then you're going to love Dr. Zand Annoying Me live on stage in London's West End this Christmas. Oi! That's right. Operation Ouch Live is back, a brand new stage version of our double BAFTA winning show on Children's BBC, running from the 4th of December to the 16th of January. Tickets available at operationouchlive.com. It's not for the squeamish, and that's why we've called it Not for the Squeamish. Oh, yeah.
What were the naughtiest things we ever did?
Oh, well, I guess the fire from your bedroom, that wasn't so good. I'd had to go to the office to get something done and was coming home and we had friends coming for lunch. And I remember Jill greeting me at the door and handing me a glass of wine and saying, it's all fine now, you don't have to worry. And I said, what's all fine? And it turned out they had been sitting in the garden and looked up at your bedroom to find flames coming out the window. And you had done some chemistry experiment. By the time I got in, Zand, you had locked yourself in the bathroom and Christopher in the bedroom. It's one of the few times I think your father completely lost the plot.
We were throwing flame objects soaked in
flaming plastic
out the window into a garden where, I mean, I don't know what we thought we were doing. So like, it's my recollection is sort of looking down and realizing it was like the ambassador's reception in the garden with the, you know, the string quartet, a rain of fire and plastic.
So you were very much a team. You were not arguing and rowing.
Mum was and is an amazing cook. She was a literary editor and she edited one of the best series about cookery ever written. We ate everything.
There was a lot of kidney and liver, wasn't there?
Yeah, I guess so.
And we were, I think we just had quite a healthy diet. I don't think you ever had a lot of processed foods. You know, sausages occasionally, yes. But you had more things like fish and chicken. Nobody was fussy. And the other thing, nobody was given a choice. I mean, it was as I grew up, a family meal was a family meal, whether it was breakfast or lunch or dinner. We all had the same thing.
There were certain things we never had in the house. We never had like chicken nuggets, or we never had microwavable chips. We didn't have burgers very often.
But we never had ready meals. We never had chocolate. We never had packets of crisps. I mean,
cookies.
Maybe if people were coming over, you might buy some crisps to put in a bowl for people. But in the house, there was literally no junk food.
You figured out something in the late 70s and early 80s that 40 years later, the science seems to have caught up with. And I'm really curious about If it was instinct.
That's right. It wasn't something that I thought about. It just didn't occur to me to ever buy something that someone else had cooked. And don't forget, there was not the choice there is now. I mean, I sometimes think, my goodness, just think what I could have done if I hadn't been making stock or soups or whatever.
What were the hits, Andy? The honey and soy sauce chicken.
That was very good. Dauphinoise potatoes.
The chicken pie with the chunks of ham in it.
The fish pie.
Fish pie.
The lemon meringue pie. A lot of risottos that were really, really
good. Oh, tandoori chicken. I mean, your Mada Jaffrey phase.
Oh, yeah. That chicken and ginger and almonds. Yeah, that was amazing.
I don't need to think hard to remember Mum's cooking. She comes around almost every week and brings a three-course meal for my family. And last week she did this lamb tagine. The point is, the bad habits didn't start when we were kids. But it is clear from talking to Mum that our whole family is obsessed with food. And from an early age, I think, Zand and I had this vulnerability to massive overeating. But we were largely the same shape until Zand moved abroad, ironically, to do a master's degree in public health in Boston. And we asked Giles about this.
The main environmental difference between me and Chris is that I lived in America for about 8 years and Chris didn't. That was where I gained most of my weight and then lost it and then gained a bit back. And I haven't not gained weight in the UK, but it does feel like a significant difference between us. Released in very different geographical locations and doing quite different things. Is it possible then that by gaining weight in the States, I haven't altered my genes, but I've altered the way that my body uses my genes so that it may be rather hard to undo the damage? Is that right?
It's entirely possible. I hesitate to use the word damage. Mm-hmm. I don't think it is damage. I think that probably changes have occurred. The main issue with body weight is that it involves the brain. And we haven't yet legally or ethically been able to go into living people's brains and remove the material in order to study it. But I think the answer to your question, Zand, is it is entirely possible that the time in the United States, which is a significantly different food environment to here in the UK, it is. And you're saying that that's when you gained most of the difference in weight that you see now?
Yeah, I think pretty much over that 1 year gained about 4 or 5 stone. I mean, just really dramatically altered my weight.
But there was another thing that happened that Zand kind of alluded to, which is at the beginning of that, sort of virtually his first day in the States, he found out that he was going to have an unplanned child, now a great source of joy at the time, a source of some stress. Is that, can I say that?
Yeah, it was a very stressful year. Chris did not have a stressful time in quite the same way. And whether it's America or stress plus America or just the stress, in my mind, is directly linked. We're going along pretty normally, and then some change in environment. What's going on inside my body?
Just listening to your story, I think you're right. It's going to be an interaction of the fact that there was a stress, but also that being in America was more permissive, meaning that it's easier to get food, that the portions are bigger, et cetera, et cetera. But the stress sounds to me like the major driver. The interesting thing is, why do some people respond to the stress by eating? And that's me, and sounds like you as well, Zand. Mm. And why do some people respond to that stress by not eating? It's the same hormone, it's cortisol that rises and chronically rises, right, and stays up there. But yet, we respond entirely oppositely to this. So I think the first thing here is that I just get the feeling that, Chris, you'd probably also be a stress eater. It's just that you haven't had the stress.
I was going to not mention this, but since you did, when I'm worried or unhappy, in Zand's position, I would have wasted away to nothing. I'm the opposite.
Don't know that, though.
Okay, that's true. I don't know that. But my experience of stress and anxiety is I stop eating. And I can certainly think of when I've been with Zand where we're both worried about a thing and he will eat and I will starve.
Okay, so if that's the case, then something has happened to sensitize Zand to stress versus you. And so I guess, what is that? Where do we respond to stress? When cortisol goes up, it clearly signals to everywhere in your body, but it also signals to your brain. And what happens with cortisol, the stress hormone, is it's unpleasant, okay? By its very definition, it's stressful. And so whatever the tactic is to try and reduce that cortisol, to reduce the stress, to make the unpleasantness go away. And for some people, Zand, me, that is eating, because eating feels nice. And so it removes that stress. For other people, it's bungee jumping, drugs, alcohol, whatever. Okay. Then the question is why? Okay. Particularly if, Chris, what you say is true, that one is a stress eater and one is not, then clearly something through your lives have changed the epigenetic marks.
Epigenetics is complicated, even if, like me, you have a molecular biology PhD. Basically, DNA is a long string of chemical letters made up of genes, and the genes are turned into proteins, which is what makes you, you. but you don't need all your genes on the whole time in every cell. So epigenetic marks are little chemical flags on the side of the string of DNA letters that help signal which genes to turn off and which genes to turn on.
And these marks can be put on or can be taken off. Depending on the environmental perturbation, and in this situation, stress, then a differing amount of these marks, these flags, are then put in front of a different repertoire of genes. Zahn, then suddenly you were exposed to the environment, and these lot of genes turned on, and you ended up eating in order to try and feel better. So it does require a significant stressor over a period of time in order for these changes to happen and to stick. But they are relatively volatile, meaning they can change over years. If you've had a traumatic childhood, if you've PTSD, you've got any number of different things. So those kind of significant experiences can make changes to your epigenetic marks.
So same genes, different environments. We're both predisposed to weight gain, but I'm not sensitized to stress for some unknowable reason, and I didn't move to America and become surrounded by unlimited, ultra-processed food.
What are we doing? I've sort of showed up to Chris's
house.
Hold on,
Bratty.
To find you on the phone. Now, don't call him Bratty on the podcast.
Bratty. Bratlington.
Do you normally call him Bratty?
Do I normally call you Bratty?
Yeah, Bratlington Stanley. Yes, 50% of the time.
Oh.
I'm trying to think of the time you've called me Jay in the recent past.
Wait, your name's Jay?
I can't think of one.
We've got a baby brother, Jonathan, Jay, Bratty. He lives in New York now. He's married with a kid. Jay's the most honest observer of the differences between me and Zand. And I wanted to speak to him to understand our relationship with food.
My memories of food and us were me asking if I could have something from the table and you guys making to pass it to me and then taking it to yourselves and emptying it all onto your plates.
What, like just a dish of pasta or something and it would just, we'd
yeah,
just take
it
all?
Yeah, if I could have some more pasta and you'd just take it all. There was a sense of kind of ruthless, like how much could you get on your plate at the start of the meal? And like how quickly that could be consumed because there was a little bit of, oh, will there be enough? Will they finish it before I can get more? Watching how you both eat, you know, like Chris fills his plate to the brim and then makes very elaborate stacked sandwiches of all the material on the plate.
Crafted mouthfuls.
You know, like you eat in a more kind of, in a kind of bird-like, a huge amount consumed, but in quite a sort of bird-like manner. That's sort of constantly moving and picking. And Zand eating is like an elephant, like eating not in size, in terms of like the mastication.
Like one of those mining, and, like an excavator wheel or something.
Yeah, like a sort of, like sort of a remorseless, like digging out the side of a mountain in Germany, like this huge digger, just kind of sweating and chewing and chewing and sweating and like just very, very slow, but absolutely relentless.
Like I'm doing archaeology and Zahn's doing mining.
yeah, like not diamond mining. I mean, like, you know, digging sand, gravel.
Like quarrying. Quarrying. So I've realised, because I'm living on my own, I'm eating in a more and more peculiar way. Yeah, I noticed the other night that my jaw was hurting because I was chewing so much. I got a piece of meat, but it was a pork chop and it had the rind on it. And I couldn't work out why I was so uncomfortable. I was trying to watch TV and I was getting uncomfortable and agitated and I couldn't work out why. My face was hurting.
I don't know how Jay gets away with this. I can never bring up food without upsetting Zahn, but somehow Jay can. He's illuminating really clearly how extremely motivated the three of us are by food, to the point of obsession, perhaps addiction. Giles's work indicates that this is likely to be genetic, but how do genes make us gain weight?
Like, I really don't understand how the genes for weight gain, overweight and obesity work. Like, they genes that would make me eat more food, or are they genes that make my metabolism worse or make me have less muscle?
I guess there are a number of different things. So first of all, how do we know that there's a genetic basis to body weight? Largely actually due to twin studies, okay, where you look at identical twins and non-identical twins. You guys know this, but identical twins are genetic clones of each other. Non-identical twins share 50% of their genetic material. So you can take any given human trait and ask, well, what happens if we share all our genes, 100% of DNA material versus 50%? And then you can then calculate this heritability with enough twins. Okay, so that basically is how we worked out that body weight was heritable, had a genetic influence. And so there are now technologies out there which allow us to look at these changes in our DNA. And we have, between you and Chris and me, we will probably have some, in the order of millions of different changes within our genetic code. But they're just very subtle changes, which make each of us behave slightly differently. And what we now know is that by studying the genetics of body weight, we're studying the genetics of how our brain influences our feeding behavior. So that's the answer to your question. And we probably got about more than 500 genes that are associated with our body weight that we know about. And the vast majority of them are enriched or work only within our brain. And where we know their function influence our feeding behavior. So why we're small, medium, and large largely has to do with how much we eat or how we behave around food.
They're not genes in our muscles, in our intestines that allow us to absorb more calories. You know, people always say, I've got a slow metabolism or I've got a fast metabolism.
There are going to be genes that influence our metabolism, but we haven't yet found them. So the vast, vast majority of genes that we have looked at, identify, and work on to date have to do with food intake. Why is it food intake and why is it not energy expenditure or exercise or physical activity or efficiency? It's effect size, meaning that a chocolate bar is what, 240 calories? Roughly.
That was said with the confidence of a man who has checked the chocolate bar. Some of them are 237.
And if one was motivated, and I often am, I can finish a chocolate bar in less than 60 seconds, correct?
Yes.
But it will always take you 20 to 30 minutes on a treadmill to burn 240 calories off. It's an effect size thing. We are programmed to eat quicker than we can burn the calories because that's what's kept us alive.
So this is such a crucial point. We do all burn calories at slightly different rates, even when we're watching TV. But every one of us has an ability to consume calories in seconds that will take hours to burn off. So how much we eat is the main thing that determines whether we are overweight. And this is heavily influenced by genes that control how our brain selects food from the world around us. So I have a plan to get Zand to quit ultra-processed food. I want him to learn about it whilst he continues to eat it. It's a bit like that Quit Smoking book, where you keep smoking as you read the book. What does Giles think of this idea and whether Zand might be addicted?
I don't think food addiction exists. It's not a single chemical or molecule like nicotine addiction or alcohol addiction, for example. That being said, I think that you can have an addictive behavior. So in other words, you can be addicted to the behavior of eating. And the reason there is the use of the word addiction is because undoubtedly, we have a series of circuits within our brain that make certain things feel good, okay, the reward pathways in our brains. And ultimately, these reward pathways are activated whether or not we are drinking alcohol or eating something nice, or even having sex. So they tend to have...
Just an evening
they tend to
in...
End up,
what is this, like a Sunday afternoon at the O House? life of a Cambridge academic. It's a lot more exciting and edgy than I thought. Sorry, Giles. You were on reward pathways.
There are ultimately reward pathways within the brain that when we feel good, these things are turned on. And this includes eating ultra-processed foods and some of the... characteristics of ultra-processed foods. I wouldn't say they're designed. Are they designed? Maybe by the companies which are trying to iterate towards something we will buy more of and eat more of, therefore. So maybe by design to tickle those pathways.
I think Chris, having had this quite extreme experience of going, wow, I never want to eat this ultra-processed food again, is also seeing the harm done to his brother by eating this amount. And so that, not just the amount, but the quality of food that I've been eating. And so that's the background to it. And you're right, like I am genuinely, when Chris proposed it, I thought, well, this is the last thing my heart needs. But one of the things, that's really interesting talking to you is the emphasis you're putting on the brain and the behavior rather than just the chemicals in the food themselves. And so that definitely makes me think that I approach a meal and I approach a food decision in a different way to Chris now, for reasons that are probably never going to be entirely clear. But that's the motivation behind doing this.
I think it's an interesting way of doing this. In other words, to try and, in effect, trigger a conditioned taste aversion, which, Chris, you appear to have gone through and come out the other side.
Giles is right. I did this experiment myself for a telly program. I was trying to understand what ultra-processed food would do to my body. So I ate loads of it and was studied by colleagues at my own hospital. And I thought it would be fun. But the more I learned from the experts I interviewed, the more disgusting UPF became. In the end, I could hardly eat it. Now, one case hardly proves anything. But it seems that whilst Giles does have some reservations, it's not a completely mad idea. I've got one more question for Giles. Are we sure that Zahn's weight, and everyone's weight, is really just about the food? What about how much TV he watches?
We know it's the food. We know that the food plays a primary role because of the genetics. But when we actually do these genome-wide analyses of populations, we're not going in asking what are the genes that are changing. We're asking where are the changes happening that explain these differences in body size. And when we look at those genes, they are all in the brain and they're all about food intake, okay? Or at least the vast majority. Now, that's not to say that the other genes are not there to be found. It's just that I think they do play a smaller role.
Giles, that's really good.
That's all right.
Take care, Giles.
Bye.
What's nice is that there's something I imagine would be quite severe about talking to a geneticist who sort of understands humans and what makes them tick. I was left feeling quite optimistic talking to Giles that I'd not been permanently damaged in a significant way. It's funny, he didn't exactly say make an effort, but he did feel that there were things that could be done. Yeah, that's the expression.
How did the discussion with Giles make you feel about this particular project, my little plan, you're on this diet? It's going to change your relationship and whether or not that would work or not.
Oh, it was quite good. It definitely got me more on board. I'm trying to think why. That it was about behaviour. That's what the food companies are playing on, that they can alter your behaviour. They can't alter your metabolism, but they can get you to consume more food. That seemed to sort of fit in with your argument. Talking to Giles definitely made me want to understand more about UPF, this category of ultra-processed food. How does it alter my behaviour? Giles sort of set up this idea of something in the environment changed and altered me, and my genetics are vulnerable to that. But I guess I still don't actually know and have never really asked what that thing is.
So far, so good. Now I need Zahn to learn everything there is to know about UPF. We'll start with a chemistry professor who's going to explain all those ingredients, things like hydrogenated oils, hydrolyzed proteins, invert sugar and flavor enhancers, emulsifiers, humectants, preservatives, and many more. And we're going to talk about it all whilst we have a tasting of some UPF.
You said you're not enjoying it as much as when we were kids.
I'm absolutely shoveling it in.
That's also interesting, is you're still eating it. Is it food?
I think it has all been designed to fool me.
You've been listening to a thorough investigation with Drs. Chris and Zand. Thanks very much to Dr. Giles Yeo. He has a new book coming out soon. I have no idea where he finds the time. And thanks, of course, to our wonderful mother, Kit, and our wonderful brother, Jay. If you've enjoyed it, please make sure you've subscribed wherever you get your podcasts, share it with anyone you think might enjoy it, and leave us a review. It all helps spread the word. Our producer is Hester Kant. The sound design is by Dan King. And our executive producers are Philly Beaumont and Joe Rowntree. The series is produced by Van Tulleken Brothers Limited and Loftus Media.